Pastor Michael is one of the few Americans who pronounces my last name correctly, McLaughlin. No, that's wrong. That's the American way, McLaughlin. But just as I messed up my own last name then, you messed up my last name at the end. So I was like, you know what? We can all feel a little humbled tonight. I bring greetings from Hope Fellowship Church in Porter Square. It's technically in Cambridge, but it's just on the Cambridge-Somerville border. I have been going there for the last 16 years, ever since I was dragged across the pond, kicking and screaming by my American husband from my homeland, the United Kingdom. I once told my best friend I was the most reluctant immigrant to America, and she said, no, that was millions of enslaved people. And I was like, okay, you're right. I'm in fact just quite a reluctant immigrant to America. But I have had the joy in the last 16 years of seeing Hope Fellowship grow. I mean, it was a church plant, I think, 20 years ago. And in the last 16 years, I've seen gospel growth in our church, in churches across Boston. And I have to tell you guys, I'm curious whether this is your experience across the river here as well. I am seeing more evangelistic opportunities now in Cambridge than I have seen in all the 16 years I've been here. And honestly, in all the decades that I've been talking to people about Jesus in the UK and in the US, I think it can be so easy to be discouraged in our sort of cultural moment, as they say. But I actually think we have one of the greatest gospel opportunities, at least in my lifetime, right before us, right here, right now. And so I want to share a few things this evening that might kind of help us with perhaps some of the harder conversations that we might have with friends who are skeptical of Christianity. And I want to offer some sort of encouragement and some Bible-centered motivation for us all to engage more and more enthusiastically, eagerly, humbly, gently, lovingly, firmly about the gospel in the context that we're in the coming year. But before I do that, because I'm English, we have this sort of congenital problem. It's actually in our DNA. We can't help it. Wherever we go, we have to talk about Harry Potter. So I just apologize for that. And if you've never read, raise your hand if you've never read the books or seen the films. Okay, so a couple of you. I need you to put your fingers in your ears for the next 2 minutes because I'm going to drop the most horrific spoiler and I would hate to be the person who did that for you, okay? So I want to see some fingers and some ears over here and over there. Thank you, thank you. If you have read the books or seen the films, you will remember that in the sixth book, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, J.K. Rowling basically sticks a knife into her readers' hearts. Dumbledore is the Gandalf of the series, if you're more of a Tolkien person. He's the only man whose power for good can match Lord Voldemort's evil. But in the sixth book, a weakened Dumbledore stands at the top of the astronomy tower, surrounded by his enemies, and he appeals to Harry's teacher nemesis, Severus Snape, for help. Severus, please. And Snape kills him. The scene is absolutely devastating. Now, we never liked Professor Snape, but we hope beyond hope that he was Dumbledore's man, and now his betrayal of his mentor is complete. It's only in the last book that we realize how wrong we were. When Harry dives into that Pensieve, the magical bowl where you can dive into somebody else's past, and there we discover that everything Snape has done has been driven by his passionate, hopeless, unrequited love for Harry's mother. We see Snape's anguish as Lily Potter is murdered by Voldemort and how he thenceforth commits himself to Dumbledore. We hear Dumbledore telling Snape that he is dying from the slow workings of an irreversible curse and making Snape promise to kill him when the moment comes. And suddenly the meaning of Severus, please, is reversed. When my non-Christian friends look over at the Christian faith, they see a lot of things that look like Snape killing Dumbledore. They see a white-centered religion with a history of racism and scriptures that condone slavery. They see an anti-intellectual mindset and a contradictory Bible that's been disproved by science again and again. They see homophobia, the denigration of women, and a refusal to acknowledge that love is love. But just as when Harry dived into Snape's memories, his understanding of what Snape had done completely reversed, so I believe that when we look more closely at each of these seemingly devastating roadblocks to faith in Jesus, they become a signpost. As I said a couple of minutes ago, it's very easy for us to become discouraged in our gospel work today. In fact, I think many Christians in this cultural moment are thinking, you know, the best thing we can do is sort of cling on for dear life and batten down the hatches while the waves of secularization wash over us. But if that's how we're feeling, I think we've actually got it completely wrong. I think we have an extraordinary gospel opportunity before us right now. But in order to grasp hold of that opportunity, I think there are four things that we need to do. Number one, we must reclaim diversity. Number two, we must reclaim the university. Number three, we must reclaim morality. And number four, we must reclaim sexuality. But we must do all of these things with humility, and not by watering the scriptures down, but by lapping them up. So number one, we must reclaim diversity. On the 23rd of February 2019, a Nigerian street preacher named Olawale Ilesanmi stood outside a train station in my hometown of London, preaching to the commuters as they went by. Two white British police officers came up to him and gave him a choice: go away or be arrested. "I will not go away," Mr. Ilesanmi replied, "because I need to tell them the truth, and Jesus is the only way, the truth, and the life." "They don't want to listen to that," the officer said. "They want you to go away." "You don't want to listen to that?" Mr. Ilesanmi replied. "You will listen when you are dead. You will listen when you are dead." And so he was arrested. What do we make of this story? Are we encouraged by our brother's faith? I certainly am. Are we reminded that preaching the gospel always comes at a cost, and that we Western context Christians have got far too used to a comfortable life for sure? But a black African Christian preaching the exclusive message of Jesus while white Westerners block their ears is a little parable for the religious world today. So if you go back 40 years, pretty much all the sociologists of religion agreed that as the world became more modern, more scientific, that religious belief would naturally decline. It's what had happened in Western Europe, where I'm from, and where Western Europe leads, the rest of the world must follow, right? You guys are meant to laugh at that. Thank you. Wrong. In the last 40 years, not only has that prophecy failed to come true, but actually, as experts now look out over the next 40 years, they're anticipating an increasingly religious world. So if you look around the world today, Christianity is the largest global belief system, with about 31% of the world identifying as Christian. And rather than shrinking, that portion is actually set to increase by 2060 to about 32%. Islam is the second largest global belief system, and the proportion of Muslims in the world is set to increase from about 25% to 31%, making it a very close competitor with Christianity. Buddhism and Hinduism are both set to decline slightly. But here's the real shock. The proportion of people who do not affiliate with any religion, so that includes atheists, agnostics, or people who would just check none on a census box if you ask them, "What religion are you?" That proportion is set to decrease from 16% to 13%. Now, the tide isn't going out on religion. It's actually coming in. Now, that comes as a surprise to many of my non-Christian friends. But what's, I think, even more surprising is that Christianity is the belief system of diversity. You know, if you look across the world today, Christianity is not only the largest, but also by far the most diverse belief system. If you look at race, if you look at culture, if you look at socioeconomics, if you look at geography. Experts think that by 2060, about 40% of the world's Christians will be living in sub-Saharan Africa. The extraordinary growth of the church in China in recent decades has brought it to the point where there are about as many Christians in China as there are in America. In many of my, especially my white friends' minds, when they think of the word evangelism, they imagine white people like me forcing my beliefs down other people's throats. But when they realize that actually the majority of global Christians are neither white nor Western, and that increasingly the majority of evangelists are neither white nor Western either, then the exclusive message of Jesus becomes harder to dismiss. Because when Oluwole Insami said that Jesus is the only way, the truth, and the life, he wasn't saying my culture's cooking is better than yours. He was saying, I was starving too till I found bread. So let's reclaim diversity. Because Christianity is the most multiracial, multicultural, multi-ethnic movement in all of history. Second, we must reclaim the university. A few years ago, I took a friend of mine from grad school, who is now a science professor at Harvard, to an event at Harvard where New Testament scholar N.T. Wright was in dialogue with the agnostic chair of the Harvard Philosophy Department. And the title of the event was The Bible, Gospel Guide or Garbage? Now, my friend is an extraordinarily intelligent guy, probably one of the smartest people I know. He is culturally Jewish and convictionally atheist. And after the event, I said to him, I know that you think that what I believe is crazy. His then girlfriend, who's a much gentler soul than either of us, said, oh, I'm sure he doesn't think that. I said, yes, he does. I believe that the entirety of human history revolves around this first century Jewish man who died on a cross and was supposedly raised to life on the third day after. Crazy, right? My friend said, yes. I said, the problem is, I think that you believe some crazy things as well. See, my non-Christian friends tend to think they are comparing Christianity with all its crazy beliefs and people rising from the dead to a perfectly coherent secular worldview that does all the work that Christianity does, except without having to believe in crazy things. But friends, that there is no such belief system. And in the coming decades, I think the university in the West is going to have to start reckoning with Christianity again. You see, for decades now, this secularization hypothesis, this idea that as the world becomes more modern, more educated, more scientific, the religious belief must decline, that has functioned in the university not just as a diagnosis, but as a prescription. You know, it's not just what will happen, but what should happen. So what are Western academics going to do when they realize that it hasn't happened? And the atheism, far from being the belief system of diversity and progress, is actually the belief system of white Western men and communist regimes. A professor at Purdue University named Fangang Yang, who's a leading expert of sociology of religion in China. And he says that the university in the West is going to have to go through a paradigm shift, much like a scientific revolution, as the failure of the secularization hypothesis comes home to roost. In other words, between now and when my little kid is in college, there's going to be an earthquake in the university. Now, this should excite us, but it shouldn't surprise us. Jesus called us to love God with all our heart and soul and mind and strength. He's not content with 3 out of 4. And if we look back at the history of the last 2,000 years of the Christian church, we won't find that it is a history of anti-intellectualism. We'll find that Christians have written some of the greatest literature of all time. We'll find that Christians have dreamt up some of the greatest philosophy of all time. And we'll find, and perhaps most surprisingly to my non-Christian friends, Christians invented what we now call science, not as an alternative hypothesis to belief in a creator God, but because they believed in a creator God who is both rational and free. First person who I had to sort of explain this to me was a guy named Hans Halvorsen, who's a professor at Princeton University. He's a professor of mathematics and philosophy. And he says that not only is it the case that originally what we now call science was developed by people who believed in God precisely because they believed in the God of the Bible, but that even today, science rests more firmly on theistic foundations than on atheistic ones. In fact, he says that atheism doesn't give you a philosophical foundation for science at all. Now, don't get me wrong, as I'm sure I don't need to tell you guys, there are many leading scientists in the world who are convinced atheists, like my friend. But also, there are a surprising number of leading scientists around the world who are very serious Christians. Before I started writing books and yapping about them, as one of my daughters calls it, yapping, I spent 9 years working with Christian professors at leading secular universities. And after that period of time, I'd got to know all these professors and their stories and their research and how it related to their faith. And pretty much every single academic discipline that is supposed to have disproved or discredited the Christian faith, I know like a literal world expert in that field who is a very serious Christian. Some of them were raised in Christian families. Quite a lot of them actually became Christians at some point in their sort of adult or young adult lives. And it's not just true of the scientists. I had dinner just last week with a friend of mine who's a professor of history at UNC Chapel Hill. And she became a Christian a year and a half ago because she became persuaded that Jesus actually rose from the dead. You know, it's her sort of professional opinion as a historian that Jesus rose from the dead. And she realized, well, if I think that, that actually has to change everything. So let's not kid ourselves. Christianity isn't anti-intellectual. It's actually the greatest intellectual movement in all of history. Number three, we must reclaim morality. I have another friend who's also a history professor, but in a university in Australia, named Sarah Irving Stonebreaker. And when I first knew Sarah, she and I were both PhD students at Cambridge in the UK. Sarah had grown up in a loving, secular, academic home in Sydney, Australia. And when she moved to Cambridge to do her PhD, she was a convinced atheist. She was also a convinced atheist when she went to Oxford to do her postdoctoral work. But while she was at Oxford, she went to a series of lectures by a fellow Australian, the world-famous philosopher Peter Singer. Now, Peter Singer is an atheist himself, and he's one of the atheist thinkers who takes very seriously the fact that if you don't believe in God, you can't just sort of trade on Christian ethics. And so one of the things that Peter Singer argues is that rather than seeing all human beings as equal because they're human, that instead we should evaluate beings, human or otherwise, according to their capacities. So, for example, their capacity for suffering, their capacity for self-awareness, etc. And according to Singer's calculation, a human infant is less morally valuable than an adult pig. Now, when my friend Sarah heard these lectures, she experienced what she later described as sort of intellectual vertigo, as she realized that her atheism, far from supporting her deepest moral beliefs, actually sort of stuck a knife into the back of them. She believed deeply in universal human rights and value. She believed deeply that the strong and the rich and the powerful hadn't no right to trample on the weak and the poor and the marginalized. She believed that human beings are all equal regardless of their capacities or their age or their abilities or disabilities. And she'd thought that Christianity was probably like the enemy of these values. But over time, she discovered that it was the basis for them. And so she ended up becoming a Christian. I read several books in the last few years by non-Christian historians who have made a similar point in different directions. One is a British historian called Tom Holland, the historian Tom Holland, not the Spider-Man Tom Holland, in case you were wondering. He wrote a fascinating, very sort of fat and interesting book called Dominion, How the Christian Revolution Remade the World. And when he set out to write the book, he was an agnostic, and he thought that his deepest moral beliefs were just basic moral common sense. You know, the idea of universal human equality and care for the poor and the marginalized, the equality of men and women, and the value of infants, et cetera, et cetera. He thought, you know, that's just like, you don't need any particular religion or philosophy to undergird those. It's just what people believe, of course. But then he started researching the history of Christianity in the last 2,000 years in the West. And what he discovered was actually his deepest moral beliefs as an agnostic were Christian beliefs. And he would now say that they're as Christian as the belief that Jesus rose from the dead. He says that if you are a sort of secular person holding on to those beliefs and trying to kind of get rid of Christianity, you're like somebody sitting on the branch of a tree while sawing off the same branch. Or some of you may have read Yuval Noah Harari's global bestseller, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. Getting a nice nod on the back row there. Well done. Again, a sort of fat and interesting book. And Yuval Noah Harari is coming from a sort of agnostic atheist perspective and trying to look at the history of humanity. And he is very clear about the fact that Homo sapiens has no natural rights. just as chimpanzees, hyenas, and spiders have no natural rights, is how he puts it. He says, human rights are figments of our fertile imaginations. Quoting the US Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Harari says, the Americans got the idea of human equality from Christianity, but if we stop believing in this God who made us and gave us souls and all that kind of thing, what does it even mean to say that humans are equal? He says, the scientific study of Homo sapiens has embarrassingly little to do with universal human rights and value. Now, as I mentioned before, many of my friends who are not Christians think that all of these things are just basic moral common sense. And the reason for that is that if you went and knocked on doors up and down Commonwealth Ave and asked people, hey, do you believe in universal human rights and value? They say, yes. Do you believe that the love across racial difference is good? Yes. Do you believe that men and women are fundamentally equal? Yes. Do you believe it's okay to kill babies, under the age of 3? No. We think that this is moral common sense, regardless of whether we identify as atheist, agnostic, Jewish, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, whatever. But actually, if you look at history, you'll find that these Christian beliefs that have been sort of packaged as if they didn't depend on Christianity when they really do. Now, of course, the message of the gospel is not, you know, we're good people, come and be like us. And if we go to our non-Christian friends and say, you know, let me tell you about my fabulous moral system and why you should try and follow it, they're not going to be very receptive. But the message of the gospel is actually, you and I, we're so bad that Jesus, the Son of God, needed to come and die for us. And we are so loved by God that he was willing to do it. And you can get in on that as well. I love what the Apostle Paul says in his first letter to Timothy. This is a trustworthy saying worthy of full acceptance, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the foremost. I think that can really inform our kind of posture as we seek to share the gospel with friends and neighbors and colleagues and family members who are skeptical of Christianity and maybe think they have strong kind of moral reasons for objecting to Christianity. But as Tom Holland points out as well, even when our non-Christian friends are pointing out all their moral objections to Christianity, they tend to be standing on Christian ground. So if a non-Christian friend ever says to you, I can't believe in Christianity because of the history of oppression, you say, well, that's interesting. I agree there's a history of oppression, but who says oppression's wrong? The answer is Jesus. I can't believe in Christianity because I've seen Christians oppressing the marginalized, the minorities. Well, who says we should care about the marginalized, the minorities? Well, actually, that also goes back to Jesus. If somebody says, look, I can't believe in Christianity because of all the violence I see in the Old Testament, you say, well, who says that violence is wrong against your enemies? Well, it's actually Jesus. It all comes back to Jesus. It's like, I don't know if you guys ever played Jenga. Someone has played it with my son. People think that you can pull Jesus out of the foundation and make a higher kind of moral tower. But actually, when we pull Jesus out of the foundation, it's more like pulling the pin on a grenade. Everything goes up in the explosion. So let's reclaim let's also reclaim diversity, but let's reclaim morality. It's late and it's Friday, and you guys are tired as well. But not in a self-righteous way. In fact, if we're followers of Jesus, we need to flee self-righteousness like toxic waste. Number 4, and I've saved the best till last, we must reclaim sexuality. When Snape kills Dumbledore, all doubt in the reader's mind as to whether he's on the side of good or evil dies as well. And when I stand for Christian sexual ethics in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I move over in people's minds from delusion to bigotry. But just as when Harry dived into that Pensieve, he discovered that Snape's story was not a story of hate, but a story of love. So when we dive into what the Bible has to say about sexuality, we will find that it's a love story too. It's just a much bigger love story than we were ready for. This love story begins in the Old Testament as prophet after prophet compares God to a loving, faithful husband and Israel to his all too often unfaithful wife. But this marriage is just in continual crisis because God's people keep cheating on him with the idols of the ancient world, the sort of so-called gods around them. And when we come to the end of the Old Testament, we're sort of left with this lingering question, how can this holy God live with this sinful people? And then Jesus steps onto the stage of human history. And one of the many strange claims that Jesus made about himself was that he is the bridegroom. Now, if you think about it, it's a very weird thing for a man to say he never married in his life on earth. So what does Jesus mean? He's saying, I'm the husband. I've come to claim God's people for myself. We see this explained further in Paul's letter to the Ephesians in chapter 5, when Paul compares Christian marriage to being like a little scale model of Jesus' love for his people. And we see it right at the end of the Bible in the book of Revelation, as this great shout goes out, the wedding of the Lamb has come, and Jesus' marriage to his church brings heaven and earth back together. Friends, this is actually why marriage is male-female, and why husbands and wives are called to different roles. Like Christ in the church, it's a love across difference. Like Christ in the church, it's a love built on sacrifice. Like Christ in the church, it's a life-creating, flesh-uniting, never-ending, exclusive love. Marriage is meant to point us to Christ. But it's also meant to disappoint us. Because even the best Christian marriage could only ever be a tiny echo of Jesus' love for us. Friends, I think one of the ways in which we Christians have often sort of gone wrong when it comes to questions of sexuality and marriage is that we have made marriage into a destination when in fact it is a signpost. We have made it into an ultimate thing when in fact it's just pointing us to the ultimate thing. We have talked often in Christian circles as if marriage is the one relationship you can't do without. No human can be so like fully complete until you find your husband or your wife. We've basically taken the idolatry of sexual and romantic fulfillment that we see around us in the culture, and we have baptized it and called it marriage. Now, don't get me wrong. Christian marriage is a really good thing. It's such a good thing that Paul said it was designed to be a picture of Jesus' love for his people. But the same Paul said that being a single follower of Jesus is even better. How could he say that? Well, because actually he was pointing to the sort of single-hearted devotion that somebody can have when their entire mind is focused on the Lord and not that they are lonely. And we often, again, get these things that are very mixed up in our church circles. Because we bought into the idea that marriage is the relationship and therefore the nuclear family is kind of the place for any sense of family. I think that's probably especially true in majority white churches. I think across the world and in different cultural contexts, we probably have sort of less of that problem and more of a strong sense of church as family. But it's something that the New Testament is so explicit about is that actually the primary family unit for Christians is not, you know, me and my husband and our three kids. It's actually our local church. And because we have lost sight of this, I think we have lost our ability to speak compellingly into a culture that has collapsed all real intimacy into sexual and romantic love. But if you read through your New Testament, you will find time and again that you are called and commanded not to get married, not to have children. Again, those are perfectly good things. But you are called and commanded time and again, to brotherly and sisterly love. Think about what Jesus said on the night that he was betrayed to his death. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he laid down his life for his friends. And we see that modeled in the life of Jesus and commanded by the lips of Jesus. We see it modeled in the life of Paul and commanded in the writings of Paul. Paul says he was among the Thessalonians like a nursing mother with her children. Now, I've nursed three children. Let me tell you, it's a very intimate experience. That was the comparison that he was making for the Thessalonians. He talks about his longing to be with his brothers and with his sisters. If you read the last chapter of Romans, you'll see four different guys who Paul refers to as my beloved or the beloved. If you read his letter to Philemon, you'll find him describing his friend Onesimus as his son and at his very heart. And imagine you go to church next Sunday, and whichever of your pastors is preaching describes another guy in the congregation as his very heart. You'd be like, oh, that's a bit much. You know, that's like maybe slightly uncomfortable, a little over-expressive. I mean, that's the language that Paul's using. Technically, it's like his intestines, because that's how Greeks use the... that. We think the heart is the seat of emotion. They thought it was kind of lower down in your guts, but same idea. And I think there are many in our culture today who understandably think that we Christians have no vision for love between believers of the same sex. But it's just not true. We have a beautiful and glorious vision, but it's not the same vision as marriage. I mean, marriage is by design exclusive. And according to the New Testament, sex only belongs in male-female marriage. But also according to the New Testament, if you read to the end of Paul's treatise on marriage in Ephesians 5, you'll find that the reason God made humans male and female in the first place and gave us marriage and united one man and one woman in this one flesh union in Genesis chapter 2 was always about Christ and the church. And we'll find this constant drumbeat, this heartbeat of the call to brotherly and sisterly love. I think of a young friend of mine who became a Christian just over a year ago. She showed up at our church in September of last year, and she basically said, you know, I've tried everything. I've tried drugs, I've tried alcohol, I've tried tarot cards, I've tried crystals, I've tried relationships with men, I've tried relationships with women. She'd spent like 18 months exclusively dating other women, has sort of lesbian tattoos all over her body. She said, none of this has worked, and I've heard about Jesus. I think I'm ready to try Jesus. I'm sort of, not by design, but by coincidence, surrounded by brothers and sisters over at Hope Fellowship Church who, were they not Christians, would likely be identifying as LGBT, or who, prior to becoming Christians, were identifying as LGBT. My friend Paige, who gave me this jacket, I only ever wear this jacket to speak, so if you ever hear me speak again, just like, expect the jacket. It's all I have. I'm not very stylish, so I just kind of do the one thing. Paige was engaged to her college girlfriend 5 years ago, having been raised in the church and then sort of walked away in college. And it was only, I guess 3 years ago at this point, that she came back to our church wanting to seriously explore Jesus for the first time. She also has a tattoo from her time with her girlfriend, but it's of Romans 8:28 on her ankle. It's sort of aged better than my other friends' tattoos since she's become a Christian. Or I think of my best friend, Rachel, who became a Christian when she was an undergrad at Yale after her high school girlfriend broke up with her. As she had previously identified as an atheist, she thought Christians were stupid and bigoted. And then one day she went to a philosophy lecture at Yale where the professor was talking about this sort of dead white French philosopher who'd given this proof of the existence of God. And Rachel thought, that's a really stupid proof of the existence of God. She wasn't impressed at all. But she thought, I haven't heard that one. And so it sort of made her curious. And she started Googling just like random religious terms. And she kept finding herself reading stories about Jesus from the Gospels. And it really surprised her because in her mind, Jesus was like a boring old conservative. She imagined like George W. Bush wrapped in a toga was like her vision of Jesus. But Jesus in the Gospels was really smart and extremely loving and like hard to place. And she found herself starting to be sort of attracted to Jesus just like as a character. She became really curious about him. But she'd sort of picked up that Christians were against same-sex sexual relationships. And she had discovered as a sort of younger teenager that she was definitely attracted to women rather than to men. And so she went to the only two self-identifying Christians she knew in college, who were a lesbian couple, one of whom was training for ministry. And she said to these young women, you know, I'm kind of interested in Jesus, and you guys have clearly figured out a way to like have both each other and Jesus, so can you kind of let me in on the secret? And they said, yes. They said, the Bible has just been misinterpreted, and if you read it correctly, it does leave room for same-sex marriage. And Rachel was like delighted by this. So she went home, they gave her a little packet to read. So she took it back to her dorm room and she started reading it and it made perfect sense. But she was a history major and so she thought, you know, I should probably read the primary literature and not just the secondary literature. So she starts Googling the passages in the Bible that this booklet is supposedly interpreting. And as she read the passages in the Bible, she thought, no, this isn't it. Like she was like, I'm not a Bible scholar, but I can tell that this isn't actually what these passages are saying. And she decided, you know what, I was stupid to think that there was room in this ancient religion for somebody like me. And a couple of weeks later, I'm sorry, it's kind of a long story, but I love it. It's my best friend's testimony. I can't help telling it. A couple of weeks later, she is outside the room of a friend of hers who's sort of inside another part of her room trying to pick some stuff up for the next lecture. And she's looking at her friend's bookshelf, and she sees a book called Mere Christianity. And she's never heard of, like, she doesn't know about C.S. Lewis or whatever, but she sees this book, she's like, oh, I'm interested in that. But she was embarrassed to tell her friend she was interested, so she just stole the book, like, slipped it into her bag. And she goes off to her lecture, and a few days later, she's sitting in the Yale library reading this book, and she suddenly, it just, like, bursts upon her that there is a God. And what's more, that this God is exceedingly holy, and that she was exceedingly sinful. She was like, it's not just that I'm sexually immoral, I was also a liar, and I was cruel and mean, and I was reading a stolen book. Like, it's like none of the data pointed to the good category. And she realized that she was actually in danger of judgment from the God who made the entire universe, including her. But right after that, it suddenly sort of clicked into place why Jesus had come, that he'd come to sort of set himself as a barrier between God's wrath and her, and so the way to be safe was to run toward Jesus and not away from him. Now, friends, in our cultural context, it seems incredibly hard to say to somebody, to follow Jesus, you need to be ready to give up your sexual and romantic fulfillment. But actually, that's precisely what all of us, one way or another, are likely to have to do. You know, what did Jesus say? Anyone who wants to come after me must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. But he also said this, whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And that has been my friend Rachel's experience, that's been my friend Paige's experience, that's been my friend Justine's experience, her of the lesbian tattoos, and it's been my experience. I've been a Christian for as long as I can remember. I don't have as dramatic a conversion story as any of them, but for as long as I've sort of had romantic feelings, they were always directed toward other young women. And if I were not a Christian, I think I would most likely be married to a woman rather than to a man today. But the more that I've studied the scriptures, the more convinced I become of two things. Number one, that the Bible says a very clear no to any sexual or romantic relationships outside of male-female marriage. And number two, that actually this is all about Jesus. And he is the one who has the right to tell us what to do with our bodies. He is the one who has the right to make a claim on our entire lives. And he is the only one who loves you and me enough to die for us. We are utter fools if we think we can pursue our sexual and romantic fulfillment and turn away from Jesus, and that's going to end up being a good decision for us. But the other thing that I have discovered experientially and seen more and more in the scriptures is that actually, when somebody leaves a same-sex sexual relationship to become a Christian, they should find more love in our communities than they ever had before. My young friend Justine, who became a Christian just over a year ago, a couple of weeks after she joined our church, she came up to me and she said, oh, I've just realized, you guys have to love me. She said, I could join any other like club in Boston and the people there could figure out that I'm weird and not want me anymore, but you guys don't have a choice, you have to love me. I said, yes. The problem is you have to love us as well. Like we're all in this together. And if we really live into the family that Jesus has called us to be part of, if we really believe that we as brothers and sisters together are one body, we are Jesus's body here on earth, then no one among us who is single is going to be lonely. No one among us who's battling with sexual temptation is going to be doing it by themselves. No one among us is going to be thinking, do you know what? I don't think I can go on in the Christian life because I don't have enough love. At the end of the day, love is precisely what we do have as followers of Jesus. And having received the love of Jesus, we need to be busying ourselves with sharing it with one another. So just to recap, we need to reclaim diversity, reclaim the university, reclaim morality, and reclaim sexuality, but we need to do all of these things with humility. We must repent of any ways in which we have allowed racism to thrive in our hearts or our communities. We must repent of the ways in which we've abandoned the life of the mind. And we must repent of the ways in which we may have been part of communities that have been like actually hateful toward people who identify as LGBT outside of the church, or places where somebody like me who experiences same-sex attraction can't get the support or help that they need from their brothers and sisters because it becomes the one sort of area of struggle that nobody can talk about. We need to take a hard turn toward the scriptures and a hard turn away from ourselves, because Jesus is not a relic of the ancient world. He is our modern world's best hope. I was hoping to leave some time for questions, and I think I have. I talked a bit longer than I expected. I'm sorry, I got a bit excited. But I think maybe we have like 10 or 15 minutes. Let's call it 10 minutes. Sorry, I should have said before, I'm happy to answer any questions. You probably are thinking, I have no questions because you didn't tell me you're going to have questions. But if anybody does have a question, I would love to hear it. Yes, thank you. Yes, I know. I think that's a question that applies in your context, and probably, you know, anyone here who's working in a secular workplace context is probably in a similar situation. Like, how can we be followers of Jesus who hold to some of the least popular teachings of the Bible today? Because let's be honest, nobody cares in your workplace if you say that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. They're like, great, enjoy, good luck. But if you say, actually, as a follower of Jesus, I don't approve of same-sex marriage for Christians, I don't affirm transgender identities, like that's a whole different conversation. The teachings of Jesus, when it comes to how do we relate to those who are outside of the faith, are focused on love, right? So when Jesus is asked, well, who is my neighbor? He famously tells the story of the Good Samaritan, which is, amongst other things, a love across racial, religious, ethnic difference. You know, the Samaritans were the people the Jews were raised to hate. And Jesus tells this story of love shown by a Samaritan to a Jewish guy who's been beaten up and left by the side of the street, to his predominantly Jewish audience. So as followers of Jesus, we are called to love those who might hate Christianity, to love those who might see us as the bad guys for one reason or another. Like, our posture needs to always be love. So the question is then, what does love look like? And I think all of us who are in sort of secular workplace settings need to be ready to lose our jobs because we're followers of Jesus. You know, if Jesus says anyone who wants to come after me is to deny himself and take up his cross and follow me, that includes being ready to lose your job. But if there comes a point where you're asked to do something that you cannot do and you're going to lose your job because of your Christian ethics, you need to make sure you're already known for your love. Now, it doesn't mean people won't say that you're hateful. They might well. But it needs to be blindingly obvious that it's not true, because you have sought to actively love the other people in your workplace, perhaps especially those who are not Christians, and especially those who might identify in ways that Christians don't. We need to make sure our record of love is evident when we have to take a hard stand. And we need to recognize that I don't know, I think of just even outside of a professional context, I work in a coffee shop most mornings of the week, and I've got to know one of the baristas there quite well. And she identifies as atheist, she is a lesbian, she also believes in reincarnation. I'm like, if there is no God, like, who's running that show? I don't really understand. But, like, she and I have, you know, got to know each other well over the last year or so, and we've talked about everything. I've told her the gospel. I've talked to her about Christian sexual ethics and how it's actually all about the gospel. She knows all the sort of least palatable things about what I believe. And I think she also knows that I love her because I, you know, treat her lovingly. And so we have a strong relationship which continues to have gospel opportunities in it. And I pray for her regularly. And, you know, we sort of sometimes laugh about our fundamentally different beliefs. But yeah, I think we have the powerful weapon of love that we can wield wherever we are. Any other questions? Yes. I'll come around here where I can see you better. Yeah, it's a great question. My guess is even if there are a few people in the room who have kids right now, there are probably many who hope to have kids at some point in their lives. So this is not irrelevant to many of us. I have three kids who are 14, 12, and 6, and they're all in the Cambridge public school system. And let me tell you, there are a few harder places to be as a Christian than in the Cambridge public school system, right? And one of the things that I've done from the ground up is I have told them, the followers of Jesus believe different things and live differently than people who don't follow Jesus. So even as like younger, you know, three-year-olds, they started school age three, they went to school expecting that their teachers and their peers may not at all believe what we believe as Christians. So it wasn't like, that wasn't confusing to them. And I've taught them from the ground up as best I can that marriage is about Jesus' relationship with his people. And that I've sort of answered all their questions as they've come up. And when questions don't come up, we just end up having a lot of conversations. So I haven't sort of waited until some age, you know, when they are ready to talk about sexuality. I've talked about it from the ground up. And one of the most important pieces, I think, for their discipleship, and it's something which I'm like deeply convinced of from the scriptures as well, is they don't just hear from me and Brian. They also hear from and see the lives of our brothers and sisters in our community. And so they don't go to school and think, well, here I'm a Christian, and then there are so many people around me who might identify as LGBT, for example. They see that, but they also see, oh, here I'm at church, and here are all my kind of grown-up friends who have come out of all sorts of different backgrounds before they became Christians. So they have positive examples of faithful Christians who are living for Jesus in the context of same-sex attraction or with a history of same-sex sexual relationships, to where it's not like they feel like their church friends don't understand what's happening around them in their school context, if that makes sense. And the one other piece I'd say is I want my kids to know that if anytime they come to me with like, hey, mom, I'm having feelings in this direction, that direction, or the other direction, that I am a safe person for them to talk to, that I'm not going to be surprised, I'm not going to be kind of panicked. I had one dear friend who was raised in a church in Florida, and he, as a young teenager, started realizing, oh, I think I might be attracted to guys and not really to girls. And he confided this in his youth minister on a Friday night, kind of like this. and his youth minister immediately called the senior pastor, and the senior pastor immediately called his parents who were already asleep. Like, wake up, like, crisis situation. And it's just like, what? We don't need to be like that, right? Like, there's a young and an adolescent boy having sexual feelings is not a crisis situation. It's a discipleship situation that all of us are going to find ourselves in one way or another. So yeah, just to kind of make it normal to have those kinds of conversations and to make it all about Jesus, because that's what it's all about. I can't. One more? Oh, sorry, you said we should. Okay, one more, if there is one more. Fine if there's not. Yes. Yeah, no, that's a great question. And actually, something that I should have said in the sort of section of diversity is that if we look at the New Testament, we will find that from the beginning that Christianity was always a multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic movement. And far from originating in the West, it originated in the Middle East. And we meet the first African Christian in the book of Acts, right? You know, in Acts chapter 8, the Ethiopian eunuch. And we see the sort of diversity, which is not just sort of accidental in the early church, but is sort of intrinsic to it, that following Jesus is breaking down all of these different kinds of barriers. It's harder for us to see it sometimes because our racial and cultural barriers are different from those of Jesus's time and place. So we, you know, we don't think of Samaritans as the hated sort of racial and religious enemy. So we don't sort of feel the force of some of the things that Jesus says and some of the ways he interacts with Samaritans, but we do see that in the scriptures. If you look at the history of interpretation, it's kind of interesting. So St. Augustine, a 4th century theologian, arguably the most influential theologian for the church after the Apostle Paul, you know, like almost every sort of strain of the church around the world has been impacted by Augustine, or at least, you know, that's maybe a slight exaggeration, but it's very broad. And he was living in North Africa. So sometimes we, even as we look back into the deeper history of the church, we might have categorized somebody as a white Westerner when actually they aren't. So I think it's helpful to look at the deeper history and to see the kinds of people who are shaping theology at an early stage aren't necessarily the ones that we kind of think of now. And then one of the gifts that we have is that we have access to the Bible actually in the original languages. My eldest daughter is like obsessed with Hebrew and Greek. Like, she's a sort of Bible nerd, and it's delightful and sort of bizarre, but she spends like hour after hour every day just like learning Hebrew passages and things. But somebody could say, well, the English translation that you are reading of the Bible was done by white Western men, so doesn't that kind of put their slant on it? And you could say, well, maybe so. Let's look at the Greek and the Hebrew and see what those, you know, what this ancient Semitic language that 3/4 of the Bible is written in, says, and let's look at the kind of Greek, which was the lingua franca of the Roman Empire at the time that the New Testament was being written. And so we can kind of, we have the opportunity to sort of dig under the surface a bit, even of some of our translations. And when it comes to questions of sexuality, which is often where people want to say, well, you're only reading the English translation, and if you look to the original, you find it says something different. It's just not true. Like, I've looked quite extensively and written a short book about it. Not that I'm the only one or the like world expert by any stretch. But actually, when you look properly at the original text in the original context, you don't find that it's giving us a totally different understanding, if that helps. All right, I'm going to sit down and let's sing another song. Oh, no, one more thing. Oh, one more question.
Hi. Hi. When you talk about reclaiming like diversity, university, could you clarify like what's the aim, what's the goal of reclaiming these, and like how do you do it?
Yeah, so starting with diversity, it was interesting. I was talking with a friend who just became a Christian this summer. She comes from Canada. She is has Vietnamese heritage, was raised Buddhist, moved to Cambridge a couple of years ago to do a postdoc. She's a scientist, and she has become a Christian just in the last few months. And one of the things she commented on was like, oh, in my lab, I know that like people will say things that are clearly like hostile to Christianity. And she's like, I don't really know what to say. Like, I feel sort of awkward because it seems like they assume that everybody in this lab, because we're scientists and we're in the West and whatever, that like none of us believe in Jesus. And like, now I do, and I don't really know what to do. And that's the situation that I see with some frequency, people reporting that you'll have a lab where it's often people who, I'm going to make some generalizations here, forgive me. There will often be kind of white male and female scientists who are proclaiming how ridiculous and absurd and harmful Christianity is, while their colleagues of color are thinking, oh, how do I tell them I'm a Christian? Like, it's sort of this ironic deal that's going on. And it's not only in labs, it's also, you know, it's frankly across the globe. So I think we need to get away from this idea that Christianity somehow belongs to white Western culture, kind of going back to your question. Not because, I mean, Christianity was obviously a huge influence on Western Europe and on white Western culture, but that doesn't mean that white Westerners like me sort of own Christianity at all. And in fact, I think we need to hear more diverse voices so that people who sort of have this idea actually realize, no, this isn't true. I can't just dismiss Christianity as like only a white Western like power grab over the rest of the world, because actually I'm telling a lot of people who are neither white nor Western to shut up if I'm doing that. And when it comes to reclaiming the university, I don't mean that like as a hostile takeover. But the reality is that many of our leading universities across the US and Europe, where I come from, were originally sort of founded specifically to bring glory to Jesus. And in many people's minds, like, the academic project is like only a story of victory over Christianity. And I actually just don't think that's true. Like, science is one example where, for sure, there have been situations, if you look over sort of history of science, there are the kind of famous conflicts which are portrayed as, you know, the virtuous scientist beats the evil Christian sort of trying to crush his scientific work. In every one of those controversies, there are serious Christians on both sides of the question. And some of the massive sort of discoveries of science, even in the last couple of centuries, have actually been by Christians. Again, not to say, I don't want to like oversimplify and say like there is one way to read science and scripture together that is like the only way to do it. There are, you know, Christians have been arguing about how science relates to scripture since at least Augustine in the 4th century. So it's not that we sort of have neat, easy answers. But what we do have, and I'm going to shut up in a second, we do have that my friends who believe that science is the kind of place where you find objective truth and anything sort of non-scientific isn't, we have a way of holding to an understanding of the created universe and sort of the discoveries of science in a positive way, and holding to universal human rights and value. That those two things go together, whereas, as you all know, Harari points out, the scientific study of Homo sapiens has embarrassingly little to do with human rights and equality. That's true. We need Christianity for that. But as a Christian, I have a reason to sort of hold together both of those areas of discovery, rather than them being kind of incoherently thrown together, which is what many of my atheist friends are kind of stuck with, if we're honest. All right, I'm done. Good night.